The Disciplined Investor is underwritten by Interactive Brokers. Savvy investors use portfolio analysts to create a consolidated view of their finances and check the health of their complete financial portfolio. Sign up for free at portfolioanalyst.com. And the Disciplined Investor is also supported by Our Crowd. Our Crowd helps you invest early in pre-IPO companies alongside professional venture capitalists. If you're interested in investing, you need to join Our Crowd for free at ourcrowd.com/TDI. That's OurCrowd.com/TDI.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
We got some dipping and then ripping. The 10-year Treasury spiking to 1.33%. Hold in the line, buy in the dip, the gift that keeps giving. And our guest today, noted researcher of shorting opportunities, Carson Block of Muddy Waters Research. All this and much more on episode number 702 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there, welcome to The Simulation, the game that's piquing the interest of people around the world. Hey, I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I'm the founder of Horowitz & Company, investment advisory, financial planning firm, also, of course, the host of this and of the DH Unplugged, co-host of the DH Unplugged podcast, where myself and John C. Dvorak get together each and every Tuesday for some fun and games. If you haven't listened to that podcast, I really encourage you to do so. I've been at this a while. Let's just say that. Not only podcasting, all right, back, 14 years now, but I've been in this investment environment in the area of finance for going on, three decades or more. Started out back in, we'll just pin it at 1990. It was really kind of 87 that I got in the business, but we'll pin it at 1990. That really is when I started getting really involved in this whole area of investing. And I've seen markets like this in the past. And yes, they can be fun. They can be profitable. There's always that question of, is this for real? I mean, it always seems like there's a bit of insanity out there when we get this kind of action. But to be honest, there's still some really amazing opportunities that are out there. But you got to know where to look. Because right now, it's all about following the momentum, trend following, technicals. These are the key components. If you get mired right now, and let me say it and then I'll come back to it. But if you get mired right now in all of the fundamentals, the underlying financials about a company, earnings, potential, that doesn't seem to really be what's in play right now. Now, that will come back. That will be something that we are going to look at again in the future. But you have to wonder, until such time, what are you going to do? We've seen the areas of SPACs, green energy, electric vehicles, all banking on this new revolution. Of course, we can't leave out the coin universe, as those are doing quite well. In fact, Bitcoin hitting new highs, Ethereum doing great, and many of the altcoins skyrocketing. Pretty amazing stuff. But what I've been noticing, which is kind of a little bit troubling, is that while I can have a stock in a portfolio, let's say we have a stock in a client's portfolio and it rips 10% for the day and maybe 25% for the month. Maybe it's at all-time highs, really great opportunity in there. I don't seem to have the desire, nor do you see the desire for many of the people that do what we do, or even maybe your average investor, about, wow, this is it. This is the stock you need to be in. Shout it out, tweet it out, and kind of get this whole style of pump going on. But if Bitcoin makes a new high, well, what happens? The evangelists, they come out, and they come out in force. And they give you every reason why it could be that Bitcoin is the next greatest thing, because it's going to be used in washing machines and you can buy it. Coca-Cola is through a vending machine, maybe automatically, or who knows, it's a transactional point, store of value. I mean, all these things come out and it's like there has never been anything before Bitcoin, and is the only thing that's going to be left standing after all of this. They come up with all sorts of reasons why you have to own this, and never again will there be, ever in the history of finance, this kind of opportunity. Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. But I will tell you that it creates a strange environment when the pumpers are doing their best on every occasion to come up with all sorts of reasons why you need to own this and why everybody else that doesn't own it is an idiot or just completely wrong, or they're too old to understand. They're too simple to understand. And why we have to have this as the new word, right? Democratization of finance because of this one particular investment. Just like GameStop was going to be the democratization of investing. AMC, Build-A-Bear, BlackBerry, these were going to be all of the next generation of how each one of us who was left out in the past is going to be able to participate. Okay. All right. If that's what it is, that's great. And they talk about, well, you need to own a certain amount. Everybody needs to own at least 1% of their portfolio in Bitcoin. I'm thinking, what does 1% necessarily give you if that's the only piece? Now, I understand having small positions of equities and building up a portfolio of equities of at 1%, 2% per for risk management purposes. But even if Bitcoin moves up by another 500% from here, that 1% is a 5% total gain of your portfolio. And what happens if it is true that they're saying that Bitcoin is going to be the only thing standing after whatever this potential catastrophe in the future is? Well, you lost 95% of the rest of your portfolio then, in theory, right? Because nothing else is worthwhile. Just hard to get your head around exactly what they're trying to do, except for just get everybody involved to try to continue this move above 50,000 and 60,000, wherever it's going, and hopefully getting it to the 100,000 mark as the tag they think will be by the end of the year. And if they think that there will be a global adoption of Bitcoin for use by central banks, I don't think so. In fact, I'm going to talk to Carson a bit about that in a moment. But we do have a lot of time slotted for our discussion today. And I want to make sure we get to that and get the full interview and commentary, because I think I have a laundry list of questions to ask Carson. And we're going to get to that right now. But before, I just want to mention and talk to all of you investment and financial advisors that are out there, because many of you have been talking about, thinking about, and maybe just wondering, is it time to switch custodians? Maybe you're going independent. Well, Interactive Brokers provides low and the lowest cost trading and turnkey custody solutions for all size firms. You can trade globally from a single integrated master account with no ticket charges, no custody fees, no minimums, and no tech, platform, or reporting fees. Plus, Interactive Brokers, as we call it, IBKR, has no advisory team or prop trading group to compete with you or your clients. So it's pretty easy. You could switch to Interactive Brokers as your custody solution and make it work for you. Go to IBKR.com IBKR.com/RIA. IBKR.com/RIA and see what's available. I think you'll be quite interested in all the offerings. As a quick note, we use Interactive Brokers for one of our strategies, and we're very pleased. We've been using them for a very, very long time, and they just keep on getting better and better with what they do. All right, let's get into our discussion right now and bring him aboard, get the phone line hooked up, and see what he has to say. And our guest today is Carson Block, and he's the chief investment officer at Muddy Waters Capital, which is an activist investment firm. And Muddy Waters conducts extensive due diligence, and it's based on investment research on companies around the globe. He also is a founder of Zeros TV. We'll put the link on the show notes for this episode over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. He is also dedicating that particular medium to short selling. So we're going to talk about that as well. Also, Muddy Waters, if you don't know them, they gained popularity and fame back in 2011 following the publication of its research on Sinoforest Corp, which was basically a fraud. Essentially, let's just get to say what it was. It was a fraud. Based in China. It was kind of an interesting thing. I followed that very closely. So, Carson, I've been trying to get you on the show since 2017. So, I guess perseverance pays off, right?
Well, they say it does. But, yeah, I wasn't trying to play hard to get. Just when you first started asking, I hadn't done any podcasts, so it was a medium that with which I had to become comfortable. And the first few that I ended up doing were with a friend of mine, Chris Irons, who does Quote the Raven. And it was good because I've got a personal level of comfort. And turns out I enjoy doing the podcast format because, in contrast to financial TV, which is, you know, maybe 5 minutes and where you get asked inane questions and you go maybe a millimeter deep. Podcasts, you can actually get pretty deep. So it's a format that I've come to enjoy. So
I love it. I mean, listen, I don't know if you know this, but I think we've officially said that now we are the longest running financial podcast ever in history, back from March of 2007.
Nope.
So Wow. Kind of evolved pretty nicely. You know, and I know Chris because I followed him on Twitter and a few other things. He has a need to use some kind of some nasty curse word in every single tweet, doesn't he?
He does, but you know, that's also part of if you meet me in person and get to talking to me, a number of people have told me that I use the F word more than almost anybody they've known. So it's a comfortable fucking environment for me. Let's put it that way. I'm on here.
I got you. So I want to start talking about the whole idea of you know, short selling and this new and renewed hatred of hedge funds. First, what is Muddy Waters? What does that phrase mean? There's a couple different things I looked up, some Chinese proverbs, and I always thought it meant kind of the whole idea of seeing clarity through muddy waters. But why do you name your firm that?
Sure. So just to dispense with the easy thing, I have no affinity whatsoever for blues music, so it had nothing to do with that.
Okay.
But when I was living in China between my second time around, between 05 and 10, I got to understand, and I was, during that time, I was a lawyer and I set up the first self-storage business in mainland China. And, you know, of course, in my mind, we were going to go IPO and be huge and, you know, reality, and can't caught up with that business plan eventually, actually pretty much right off the bat. But, you know, one of the frustrations of doing business in China is that there are so many layers to every transaction. And I used to call them value subtraction layers. And there's so many people in that economy. So much of that economy is really based on opacity and being able to make money off the lack of transparency, off the opacity. So there's a Chinese proverb, muddy waters make it easy to catch fish, hun shui mo yu. And I didn't understand what that meant the first time somebody said that to me, because that was said to me when I was asking a local government official. I was complaining about how the high-speed train tickets would get sold out ahead of the Golden Week holiday periods. And then you would have these dudes in front of the train station scalping the tickets. And
right, so it's Ticketmaster China.
Yeah. It was more like the guys at Yankee Stadium, right? But this was hardcore illegal, and the government in China runs everything of importance. So I asked him, I was like, God, you know, why does the government allow that? And he said, muddy waters make it easy to catch fish. Okay, what the fuck does that mean? So he said that when he was a child or a teenager, he was sent down to the countryside during the Cultural Revolution, and he went into this, he was hungry, and so he went to this pond, and there were fish in it. So he got in the pond, and he's trying to grab the fish with his hands, but he was unable to. He remembered the proverb, so he kicked a bunch of silt up from the bottom of the pond, and it forced the fish to surface, and he grabbed him. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it made sense to me. Ah, okay, so China, this explains probably 90% of how China works. Opacity creates opportunities. So when I started Muddy Waters Muddy Waters LLC, it was Muddy Waters Research was the brand at the time, in 2010, I started it because I had just come across a total fraud from China listed in the US. I did not yet know that this was systemic. I just thought this was this one fraud. So I really started this business by accident. But I thought, okay, well, here's a, you know, fake company that's trying to take advantage of the opacity of China as far as U.S. investors are concerned, the cultural barriers, the time difference, the language barriers, the different legal system, et cetera. And so at the time that I started, I thought, well, maybe there's a consulting business or something I could do here helping investment banks, due diligence companies, as if they would ever actually want the help.
right.
And so, I didn't yet get, you know, what was going on in the markets with China. So, that's how I picked the name, because it explained what these guys at Orient Paper, that was the name of that fake company, explained what they were doing. And like I said, it pretty much answers almost every question you'd have about why does XYZ happen in China?
You know, it's interesting. So I don't know if you ever thought of this, but so here I am on the other side of this, right? I didn't own any shares, but on the other side of what was going on. And I was watching this thing very carefully because I was really fascinated with what you were doing back then. Okay. And, I'm watching this now. At first, nobody believes, right? You know, we're thinking, some guy saying it's a fraud. He's probably shorting the stock or something. Who knows what's happening, right? And then we start getting into this, and how do you stick to something, right? Because to be honest, there's always multiple sides of all of these things. And while you had high conviction on this, you know, you have to wonder, how hard is it for you to stick to an idea that you have some like core belief in and through all of this? Because sometimes, like, for example, you have a short position that you're calling out right now. Why? What's your, you know, from the date that you called it to now, you're off on that. Mm-hmm. So how do you stay with it?
So, all right. So if we look at Orient Paper, and then I'll contrast it with today and why, so with Orient Paper, the circumstances, which I came across that were kind of unique. I used to work with my father, and my father was, an equity analyst and institutional salesperson covering U.S. centric micro cap companies. And I was working with him from 99 through 02 when I went to law school. And then a little bit, I did some, I helped him some while I was in law school. But my father it was 2009. It was, you know, kind of at the, he was at the end of his career, and he got interested in these U.S. listed China companies. The microcaps that had gone public via RTO. And he asked me to diligence help look at some of them for him. And he'd just been to a Roth conference, and he was telling me about all these exciting companies. And look, I had no reason to believe that these were the kinds of frauds that they turned out to be, right? Like I practiced law in China. I had co-authored Doing Business in China for Dummies. I was head of the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai's Entrepreneurs Committee. So I knew what the deal was on the ground in China. And so I thought that really the question is going to be, how much money is the chairman stealing out of the company? And, you know, is it too much or is it an acceptable amount? So
that's your baseline. That's the baseline.
I mean, look, American investors didn't approach, even before I started Muddy Waters, right? Like when I had this, you know, when I had the self-storage business and after I'd written Doing Business in China for Dummies, I got, you know, like I was asked to speak to people, especially MBA students who were visiting China. And what I always emphasized to them was, you know, the problem you come in with as a Westerner is you ask, well, why would he lie? Why would he do this and that? I said, you're asking the wrong question. The question you need to ask is, why wouldn't he? Stop asking why would. It's all, why wouldn't he lie? Why wouldn't he steal? So, and that's really how Chinese do business with each other. I mean, it's a caveat emptor society there. And it's, you know, and it's incumbent on you to really, you know, to basically assume that somebody will take advantage of you if you give them the opportunity. I mean, that is how you survive in business in China. So I was barely surviving in China. And when I, you know, when my father asked me to take a look at Orient Paper, and again, going in with a level of skepticism that sounds shocking for, you know, to an American, but was too credulous, as it turns out. I mean, what we saw was a Potemkin factory. And actually, my first clue was really, I didn't read the filings until the day before we went to the factory. And I wasn't that enthusiastic about doing this, to be honest. My father was asking me to do it as a favor. I had a lot of other things going on, you know, just trying to keep my business from failing. So a friend of mine whose background was in manufacturing, we engaged him as a consultant, and he and I were sitting in the Shanghai airport, snowed in. So we had a long session in the cafe there, reading through the filings for the first time. And we were repeatedly laughing out loud. I mean, the claims in there, you know, the prices that they claim to be paying for their, you know, for their land leases and their construction costs. I mean, it was complete bullshit. And, right. You know, it was just obvious there were some serious problems. But then when we got there and it was this Potemkin factory that, you know, they had claimed done, you know, that allowed them to produce $103 million in revenue the year before. I mean, it was so hard for us to keep a straight face. So that is, you know, so basically getting back to your question, how do we retain conviction? Well, I didn't know what to do with it at that point. And this was January of 2010. I figured, you know, so I told my father right after this, and he had no interest in shorting this. He's never shorted a stock. And he said, fine, you know, I'm just walking away from this. But I then thought about, well, let me see if there's a way to get economics in shorting this, because by this point in time, I was effectively broke. I mean, I was broke. I'd gone to China with, you know, like $500,000 in savings. I was a 30-year-old, you know, guy, and I thought that was top of the world. And I now owed about $200,000 to my father as a result of the miracles of the self-storage business in China. And never try to create a market in a foreign country unless you are a real multinational is another lesson that came out of this. But anyway, I looked around for somebody to partner with, and, you know, I talked to some people who are in the investment business in the States, and everybody ran away from this idea like it was radioactive, you know, like, we're not going to short this thing and have you put a report out. Oh my God, you know, compliance doesn't even know I'm emailing you back. They told me not to talk to you ever. So, I know literally, like I had somebody say that to me. So I then after, you know, after going nowhere with this, I just thought, all right, well, I don't know. These guys, I think I get it. I think this is probably some kind of pump and dump like we used to see in the 90s on Wall Street. You know, these guys are probably like Chinese organized crime connecting with, you know, like the old Italian guys who were, you know, running these scams on Wall Street. They're going to blow the audit. There's no way. They just switched auditor to BDO Limited out of Hong Kong. There's no way they can get through this audit. So I put it to the side and forgot about it. Well, in early April, I just remembered. I'm like, oh, yeah, let me see what's happening with Orient Paper. You know, I'm sure the stock is halted. So I pulled it up on Yahoo Finance and no, it had the same market cap that it had back in January and it was still trading. Oh, that's odd. Were they able to file the 10K? I looked it up. Yeah, they filed the 10K. What? I'm thinking like, okay, there's got to be at least a qualification of some sort in the audit opinion. No, completely unqualified.
Wow.
So that was a seminal moment where, I mean, again, I didn't yet know it was systemic, but I'm going, God, how could these guys miss that this thing's such an obvious fraud? I mean, the factory is basically fake. So I put together this report as a side project over the next few months and sent it out in about, I think it was June 28th of 2010. I emailed it to 25 people I knew from law school roughly and 50 people in the markets I'd mostly last talked to 9 or 10 years earlier. And, you know, I was broke. So my friend and I each bought $2,000 of put options. Having no idea like how to trade these things. And to me, it was important to make it seem like we were short in size. I mean, we never said we were short in size, but I was just worried about getting sued. Like I did not have the money to deal with the lawsuit. So we put it out and it went viral. And I thought if we were successful, maybe the stock, which was at roughly 8.5, maybe, you know, the stock would go down to like 7.75 or something like that. This stock was down 55% the next day. And
wow.
Then the company came back at us, right? So they put out this press release, you know, these are all lies. Carson Block and his father tried to extort us for $300,000. We said no, and that's why they've published this. So here's the thing. You asked me how I kept conviction. Yeah. Now I'm like, all right, motherfuckers, you just lied and you lied about my father. And now I'm not going to stop. I'm going to keep going until it's clear to the whole world that you are a bunch of fraudsters. And so that was it was very, 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 very personal for me in that instance. Now, you know, and it was right after that that a bunch of people reached out to me and said, this is systemic, you know, look at this company, look at that one. And I'm just cracking open these 10Ks and I'm just astounded that all of these companies were trading with market cap, that they were getting unqualified audits. I mean, the red flags were so obvious just from reading these 10Ks. And then, you know, you fast forward almost 11 years and, you know, you ask about YY. Look, YY Live, we were working on this one for over a year. We were working on YY. And, you know, it was just this bizarre timing where right before we were going to do something, it was reported in Chinese paper that Baidu was going to buy YY Live or probably going to buy YY Live. So YY had its earnings date fixed. Its earnings announcement date fixed for November. And then Baidu announced it, and it's the same day, same time. So we're thinking like, okay, you know what? They're going to announce that either they have bought it or they're about to buy it. And we knew YY Live is, you know, like a total fraud. And so we had this question internally, like, look, we can go public with this, you know, but Baidu probably buys it. Why? They knew it was a fraud. Of course they knew it was a fraud. They do not care because Baidu itself commits fraud. I mean, it's not a zero. It's not a total fraud the way that YY Live's business is, or that's a near total fraud. But yeah, I mean, the stuff that they did with iQIYI, We researched that along with Wolfpack Research. And there are things that we never, you know, we never published on about how before IQ went public, the accounting that Baidu employed with it that we felt was fraudulent. So, I mean, this is China Inc., right? Like, nobody from China has ever been held materially accountable for scamming U.S. investors. It's just it's like a heads, they win, tails, they don't lose proposition. Yeah. So, you know, like, does it shock me that Baidu said, we're going to buy it anyway? No, it doesn't shock me. It's a total fraud. Baidu doesn't care. I'm not even convinced when they say they're paying $3.5 billion, I'm not even convinced that they really are paying that much in real cash, you know, because it very well could have been a, you know, a way to deal with a fake cash problem. So just to quickly go into that, when you report fraudulent profits as a business, you should have cash in the bank. And you see this all the time with these China companies where they, you know, they become very, they keep investing and acquiring and things like that. And a lot of times, I mean, you can, our websites, just all these companies that we've reported on over the years from China, you'll see that inflated CapEx, they buy something that really cost them $100,000. They claim to cost $10 million. And that's an excuse to not have cash. So I suspect that Baidu could have been dealing with a fake cash problem there too. But, you know, that's speculation. But in any event.
Yeah, well, I want to talk a little bit about more about China. So just hang on to that thought for a second, because I've been there. I want to go through that. But I wanted to just talk for a second, just take a moment to talk about our crowd, because a lot of people have wished that they were in early on some of the best performing IPOs of 2019 and 2020. And our crowd investors were. And now you can join in what's next. With our crowd, accredited investors have access to invest directly, easily, and most importantly, early. Our crowd investors have benefited from our crowd companies IPOing, like Beyond Meat, or being bought by companies like Intel and Nike, Oracle, and Microsoft. Our crowd's investment professionals leverage their extensive network to review some of the most promising private companies and startups in the world. They do an in-depth due diligence and meet with the management and understand more and comprehensively about the companies, the deals, they vet them. And today you could join our crowd's investment in Future Family. This is a fintech innovator removing the cost and complexity and the barriers of fertility care as they transform the rapidly growing multi-billion dollar fertility care industry. Future Family's products give everyone the opportunity to build the family of their dreams. And you can get in on Future Family. You can get in early on this and other unique opportunities at ourcrowd.com/TDI. The Our Crowd account is free. Just go to ourcrowd.com/TDI. So we left off with the discussion about China, right? China. Now, I'll tell you something, a couple things here. So I've been to China several times. It's one of my favorite areas, Asia. My second trip, which is probably around this time that you were doing the investigations and the research on these companies. I witnessed something which was very hard to explain to people. And that was very simple. I was just driving down the road and I heard about these ghost cities and this whole idea of, you know, just kind of these buildings that are just, you know, not occupied. I'm thinking, okay, you know, what are we talking about? I was going down the road. I must have gone down the road 50 miles on this particular road. And it was building after complex of these things that were built with absolutely nobody living in any of them. Nor was it going to be that anybody would live in them. And I asked the guy in the car, like, what's the story with this? He said, it's all about us building and the local mayors and the various people that are involved in the community have brothers that do the glass and do the concrete. Yep. And, yep, you know, we do all this and we build and we get money from the government and we just build these things. And I guess I said, well, what happens after a while? He says, well, we'll just somebody else is probably a cousin in the demolition business and they'll demolish the building and then just do it right up again. So
Yeah, no, that's exactly true. And that's one of the reasons why things are built so poorly in China is because it doesn't matter. They'll just, you know, they want to be able to build the things again. And corruption is a huge part of it. Every time something is built with other people's money, whether it's a builder is a private business or it's the government, it's all about skimming. And they skim real money. I remember, so I was living in Shanghai when the 2010 World Expo happened in Shanghai. And sitting around, you know, well, different times I asked this question, but, you know, most of my friends were foreign entrepreneurs in China. So people who I felt like had a real good understanding of China, because to understand China, you really have to understand it from the trenches as opposed to the ivory towers. So mm-hmm. the ivory towers would be the account or, you know, like the law firms, you know, where I started or where I started in 05, my second time living there. But the trenches are when you're doing all of these small and for you big transactions in China and understanding how stuff works. So remember, I was fascinated by this question. So the government was advertising. I mean, they were so proud of the fact that they were spending some insane amount in preparation for the World Expo. I mean, in the tens of billions of dollars that, you know, that they were advertising, they were spending. And so I asked everybody, I was like, all right, what do you think like the margin is? Like, how much of that money is going to be stolen? And it was a very clear consensus where it's, you know, like if everybody were being, you know, like the clear consensus was if we're being conservative and think that it's not too egregious, 20% of it gets stolen.
Wow.
You know, so it's 20 to 40%. Look, that's how so much of the world works, you know, and it works outside of developed Western countries. But yeah, I mean, it's, with those real estate construction projects, of course. I mean, you know, one of my friends also one time, a foreign entrepreneur who, you know, had the pleasure of driving his own car around China. Well, I ultimately had to drive myself too. But I remember one day he came over and he was just railing about how he'd had the worst day because he was trying to drive to some factories and they'd, you know, and they changed all the road names or the freeway names there in the Shanghai area without, you know, any real announcement. And so my wife asked him, like, you know, why did they do that? That's so dumb. And he just looked at her and was sort of like, you know, sort of like a duh, Kath, don't you get it? And he said, to sell more signs.
Ah.
Yep. You know, some truth to that.
Yep. So let's talk about, so I want to do two topics, but I really want to get into this idea of passive investing and your comments on this, because this is something that I've been swirling in my head for a while. And I've been talking about a few years ago, fell on deaf ears, to be honest with you. But I think there is something more here. But there's a general hatred for right now, this moment, right, with the hedge funds and what happened with GameStop. And it's all about these terrible hedge fund people, you know, that are these, you know, who are they? And short sellers. Now, since you are a seasoned short seller, I've always said that it's a necessity to have short sellers in the market. In fact, I've said during times of market strife, when you have a significant downstroke, you should be kissing the toes of the short sellers, because those are the ones that are going to step in and probably start to level out the markets or maybe a position, because they're going to actually want to cover by buying their position back. If there's no buyers otherwise, and people are running through the streets panicked and nobody's, you know, with the old, I'm never buying a stock again in my whole life, the short sellers somewhere in this whole process are going to be ones usually that start that basing. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think, look, I'd go deeper than, well, let's start with one thing here. The number of short sellers has decreased markedly since 2009. And if you look at the short selling or short oriented management firms, I mean, the ones that are still left, I mean, vast majority are not left, but You could see Kinnikos, which was once the biggest short selling firm in the world. I think it peaked maybe 2013, about $7 billion in AUM, according to its form ADV. That's probably RAUM, but I mean, I think they're just about $1 billion now, according to their latest ADV. Wow. And they're one of the few survivors.
That's Jim Chanos.
That's Jim Chanos. They are one of the very, very, very few survivors. You know, so when people are out there, you know, like accusing short sellers of being the boogeyman, it's honestly like, what short sellers? I mean, the amount of AUM globally that's in short-oriented or short-focused strategies, if I'm being generous now, maybe adds up to $5 billion. How many trillions of dollars are there in long-oriented strategies? So when people are looking at stocks falling, look, managements have been doing this, you know, ever since there were markets, blaming the short sellers because it's a great distraction from their own failings. And it's easy for people to dislike short sellers because short sellers are intuitively, or short sellers are effectively saying, yeah, we really disagree with everybody who's long this. We think they're missing something. So it's kind of like, you know, short sellers are a little bit like, you know, effectively like wise asses, right? Saying, eh, you know, we're smarter than you are, you know, so right. That's why right. We're short. And that, look, just most people don't like that. So I think it's, you know, so there's something very emotive about knowing that there's somebody on the other side of this trade here. And managements are able to spin that in creating this mythology that the shorts are trying to put the company out of business.
Yeah, and, overstock. You know, remember overstock?
Yeah, well, yeah, and like a lot of people believe, right? And a lot of people believe like, well, if the stock goes to zero, the company's out. No, it's not out of business. The stock can go to zero. It's not out of business. Like that doesn't put a company out of business. And short sellers aren't the ones who push stocks down because there just isn't enough firepower for them. When stocks go down, it is almost always largely due to the long holders who are selling. So that's something that's important to say. Now, going back to the state of short selling and how there's barely anybody left who does it, you know, I think a lot of people might feel like, oh, great, you know, screw those guys. But, you know, like maybe the analogy that I've kind of been thinking about the past, I don't know, couple weeks is short sellers are kind of like the good bacteria in your gut, right?
Yeah.
And people might say, well, they're bacteria. I don't want it. I don't want that bacteria. But you actually need it. And if you don't have it, it's not a sign of health. You probably have bowel cancer or something like that. And so when you look at the fact that there are no short sellers left, basically, I mean, is it really because we as a society have really figured all this out? And, you know, and things can, you know, and like there's only blue skies ahead for the economies and people of this world? Or is it because this market is held together artificially with alchemy and that it really has ass cancer? And it's because it has ass cancer. Yep. So that is, you know, so I think that's something that people, if they can kind of put the pitchforks down for a moment, they should step back and really think about the implications. Like, what does it mean that there are very, very few skeptics left? Is this a good, is this a sign of market health or not? And I would argue that if you know what you're talking about and you think about it dispassionately, you would have to conclude that this is a sign of tremendous ill health in the markets.
Yeah. Let me ask you this quick question because it's something I've always wondered about. Is there a correlation to the time it takes for a company to fire back a full rebuttal on a short report and the potential for how great the fraud is?
You know, I used to think that it's all over the map, honestly. I mean, every time it's funny, I've taken to saying that it's the ones who sue me, you know, I guess I get sued on average once every 2 years. The ones who sue me are never the ones you'd think sue me, or at least not under the circumstances, or at least they're not the ones that I think right off the bat would sue me. So I don't think there's a correlation. I mean, you could look, when a company does come back really hard and ad hominem, it's clear that, you know, you got pretty, you hurt them, right? You know, that and that's pretty close to the bone, and they're trying to distract. But that is a strategy that was largely, I think, promoted by the crisis PR firm. So as soon as short report hits, like, I think these crisis PR firms are calling the company and trying to sell their wares. And, you know, to the company's credit, I think they've figured out that that's actually the least effective way of dealing with short sellers, is to, you know, try to make it, you know, to counter with ad hominem attacks and smear. And part of the reason it's so ineffective, I mean, I'm just going to tell you from my side of the table, and you asked me about this, it, you know, this touches on a question you asked earlier. If you make it personal, then it's much more engaging to me, honestly. I mean, doing this all these years, you know, it's like at times it's kind of numb, you know, you have to be kind of numb, because I just feel like we see so many abuses. And not only in the markets, I mean, I'm kind of a magnet. And back when I was traveling, I would be a magnet for people coming up to me and telling me about all kinds of crazy stuff that goes on. I mean, political corruption, and we trawling the sewers of the world's financial system. I mean, you really get to see how
a lot of gunk.
A lot of world sausage is made, and it's bad stuff. So I have to say, at times I'm just kind of numb. You know, I'm like, another fraud. All right, well, you know, fuck these guys. Let's you know, do the analysis and put it out.
Right.
But if they make it personal, all right. Yeah. Now it's on. Now my juices are flowing again in ways they haven't since the early days. So the smarter thing for companies to do is to just not really, you know, try to engage and make it worse. So the sooner they can figure that out, they'll save, you know, they won't waste money on crisis PR firms.
Right.
And B, they're doing better by their shareholders.
So let's talk about this major item that really you have been pressing right now. And I think there's some legs to this. I really do believe, like I said, I've talked about this for years and it kind of fell on deaf ears, but maybe you have a better angle on this whole thing, or maybe it's become a tipping point. This idea of passive investing, right? So there's all these ETFs. There's an ETF for any kind of flavor. There's probably a chocolate ice cream ETF out there, right? And you know, you have all this passive investing because all the active people just said, screw it. You know, people are like, let's just do the low fee. Let's just get into the S&P. Let's get into the small caps. But you are making the commentary and saying that, you know, this could be a really big problem for markets, right?
Yeah. And so let me just preface this by explaining that I wish I could lay claim to this intellectual framework, but I can't. I'm friends with a guy named Mike Green, and I met Mike back in 2013. And it's, you know, he's just this incredibly smart person, and like, I mean, a good number of smart people, and he definitely stands out. Last year, I mean, just watching some of these things that we were shorting, like GSX, which is a near total fraud from China. And, you know,
that's the learning company. Education.
Yeah. I mean,
well, that's what they say they are.
Students, but yeah, I mean, ostensibly.
Right.
And four other credible research firms have come out and concluded the same thing. And it's just ripped. I mean, it's tripled. And it's done that twice. Since our report, and it really, yeah, and another one that we shorted in the fall, Nanox, which is a scam. You know, these things are going up, and we're sitting here thinking, okay, these are definitely different markets, and it's really about technicals. So I started getting into this, and I initially began trying to go down the rabbit hole of, you know, algos and HFTs. But toward the end of last year, I started talking with Mike, because I know he's been studying market structure. And I was trying to talk to him about HFTs and algos. And he said, well, no, like, what's really going on here? The single biggest factor is passive. And look, as somebody who focuses on microstructure, of course, I knew passive is, you know, something that we had to take into account when we looked at companies. But I didn't, you know, so if a company had, you know, Vanguard and BlackRock as the numbers one and two holders, like, you know, we knew it. There's no point in ever researching that company. But I kind of assume that passive had a more limited effect, you know, just sort of case by case and maybe kind of a linear, slightly somewhat upward sloping impact on prices. But Mike, you know, Mike said, no, listen, his estimates, he said, I estimate that when an active manager puts a dollar into the market, it results in an aggregate increase in market cap of $2.50. Now, there's a multiplier because, you know, the float is smaller than the market cap and you have to pay up to induce somebody to sell to you, but he gets $2.50. He said, however, I estimate that when passive puts money into the market, it increases the aggregate market cap on average by $17.
Wow.
And I was like, Jesus, like, wait, dear, you know, 17 for passive, 2.5 for active. Explain how this works. Cause I was incredulous, but actually it's pretty intuitive when you get to it. So the issue is that so long as passive has inflows, passive A will not sell and B must buy and will buy at any price it needs to pay. So as passive, and so Mike talked about this, he said, the analogy he used was you have a bag of marbles and half of them are black, half of them are white. So it's 100 marbles, 50 black, 50 white. Now, if you say black is active management, white is passive, well, when passive buys, it's replacing active in the float. So you start pulling black marbles out and replacing them with white. And so now your supply of stock that can be sold gets smaller. And, you know, that also, I mean, you also map that with this hodling mentality that has gotten into markets in large part, I mean, because of passive. And so passive just has to keep paying up to in order to buy because it has inflows and it's not selling. And so when you look at, you know, and one of the things that I've been saying last year, well, I mean, I've been saying it for a while, but we were really trying to think about, you know, the world and, you know, from long investors' perspective. And I said, well, you know, growth has been dominant because, you know, we live in a world where, you know, the winners win. Now, that sounds pithy and you can go and repeat that, but the reality is I had no idea why. And I think passive explains that because if you go back in time and a company is growing, you're going to get some active buying it. But then what happens is passive ups its weighting of that because these things grow in relation to other companies in the indices because their market caps are growing.
Well, that's what it is. It's the market cap weighting. That's it's not necessarily passive. It's the way the passive indices are created.
Right. And so that so when you look at, okay, why has growth outperformed? I think this explains a lot of it. And the, you know, one point that I should have mentioned a few minutes ago, but you get to this point where rather than passive's impact on prices being linear, it's convex, it's exponential. Because again, as the float shrinks because passive replaces active and passive is paying higher and higher prices, that's pushing these things up even more. So it becomes this very convex price behavior, and that in turn grows the market caps, which grows the weighting, which mandates more buying by passive. So it's this really bizarre feedback loop, but I think it explains a lot of why growth has outperformed. And to be honest, so I mean, I think it, the reason I buy so much into Mike's conclusions here, because I haven't done the math myself, but the reason why at a high level I buy into his conclusions is probably 80% of the times I've asked over the past few years a question that starts with the phrase, why the fuck?
Yeah.
can be answered by this theory. So
what happens on the other side, though? What happens on the other side is passive selling that much more demonstrative and that much more of an exponential impact on the markets, or can it be?
Well, that's the thing. So if this all sounds, again, if you take this view, you know, similar to my point about short selling, you know, if you take the view that, well, if things are going up, you know, like very shallow, unsophisticated, not thinking ahead a little bit view is, well, this is all great, right? Like prices go up, so we're creating wealth. Well, what happens when the day comes and passive has outflows and passive has to sell? And there's hardly active left to buy. And I mean, probably active would be selling at the same time too.
Right.
I mean, this just creates a tremendous amount of fragility in the markets. And this has real world consequences. I mean, you know, Mike and I co-authored an FT op-ed a week and a half ago. And the way that we put it is, you could, I mean, I'm not trying to fearmonger here. It's, you know, there's so much that's unknown. And in the key point here is we just have, there's no view on when this happens, but you could have a 1929 through 1932 style crash or magnitude crash, but it could happen at like 2020 speed, basically. You know, when you have a market that just, you know, would have this wave of passive selling without a real bid there. So, especially without the short sellers being there, because you brought that up earlier, short sellers could be your backstop and help to stabilize things. Well, guess what?
Now, then we have the Fed coming in Japanese style.
What's that?
Then we have the Fed coming in Japan style. You know, buy up the ETFs.
Look, so right now the Fed does not have legal authorization to buy equities.
Wink, wink.
They could get the legal authorization to do it. But I mean, it's, you know, but right now we don't have markets that are, I mean, when markets are malfunctioning to the extent they presently are, they're not fulfilling their societal purpose. Like, why do we have markets? It's actually not to entertain us in non-COVID conditions. Yeah, I know, right? Imagine that. And if you want to gamble in non-COVID conditions, like, you know, there are places where you can go do that. But markets are supposed to allocate capital within the economy to the most efficient users, the companies that are going to earn positive returns on that. And once the turbocharging dynamics of what's going on with passive are, of course, leverage and, you know, the really active options markets. But I mean, once you get to this level, markets are not allocating capital efficiently. And that has real problems. I mean, this is, if you believe that markets produce the best economies, and obviously markets are not perfect, this is definitely, once we have a greatly distorted market, we're definitely not getting to optimal economic outcomes. And I think that's why we're stuck in this boom and bust cycle. And guess what? Like roughly every 10 years, things blow up and wealth is transferred from a lot of people to a small number of people. And this is part of the concentration of wealth and power. It's a big part of that story as far as I'm concerned. So these things have real societal, the markets have real societal ramifications. And, you know, if I could pontificate for another moment here, you know, I think that, I mean, how ultimately, the way that society rewards people will, who gets rewarded and how they get rewarded, shapes that society. And when we have a market that is bestowing tremendous rewards on people who don't necessarily deserve it, a lot of people who do the wrong thing, I mean, from my chair, get rewarded, you know, with ungodly sums of money for that. That has a real warping effect on society. And I used to say, like, every now and then I try to think in a semi-thematic way, and I used to say that we live in the age of venality. But I mean, it just dawned on me the other day that the age of venality, that was kind of the good old days. I mean, this is
beyond that.
This is the age of moral rot. And the markets have a lot to do with this. You know, it's a feedback loop between markets and society, society and markets. So
once you start getting people having the desire to become evangelists of a particular stock or a particular Bitcoin or whatever, you start to wonder, like, what exactly is going on here? And we've seen a lot of that. So there's definitely a good amount of rot that's involved here. And like you said, you know, it's like everything else. It's every 10 years or whatever the time period is, there'll be something that does pop up here and hopefully cleans us to a point that we can get rid of some of the scraps. The problem, though, has been that we're not allowed to fail, right? Isn't that the big problem? You know, governments. Yeah,
nobody has the political will. Nobody who is, you know, can affect these changes. Nobody has the political will to let that failure occur, for us to press the reset button and get, you know, try to get on firmer economic and market footing.
I always said it like this. Listen, you know what? We have, you're a bit younger than I am, but I had kids when the whole trophy for everybody started, right? You know, the participation trophy. I'm like, no, excuse me. Please do not give my son that trophy. He sucked at baseball. You know, don't, please don't, you know. And I said, they're like, what are you talking about? It's going to hurt him. I said, let me explain what you're doing here. What you're doing is that you are potentially keeping my son in the outfield for another season, even though maybe he's really bad. Whereas if you told him, dude, you know what? Maybe baseball's not the best sport for you. Who knows? Maybe he'll pick up a tennis racket. And maybe he'll be really good at that. And now what you're doing is stymieing the opportunities because we're continually just providing this, oh, you're so good, Johnny. You know, and it's really, unfortunately, you're really twisting the whole process of it's not really a survival of fittest, but it's you know, what you end up being good at is because you could try different things, not just making sure everybody just feels happy. Don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's, you know, like that gets into a lot of, you know, what, or some of what's kind of going wrong culturally and politically here in this country. But the one thing I say, I mean, I presently live in Northern California. I've got young kids, you know, we're leaving California this summer. And, but, you know, part of it's just because it's really this, you know, that dynamic is so pervasive where I live. But the one thing that I keep thinking, especially because I've had the benefit of having lived a significant part of my life overseas, you know, having traveled a lot. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, seeing how a lot of the world sausage is made, is that this is not how the rest of the world works. And you're just not preparing kids well to deal with, you know, to deal with that. Not everybody's a nice person out there. And, you know, just, yeah, giving kids pats on the back consistently, even when they don't deserve it, it's probably, you know, it's probably the worst thing for their self-esteem over the medium to long term, even though it's intended to bolster their self-esteem. And look, I mean, my oldest kid is, you know, is seven. So really, what do I know about parenting? But, you know, we'll put all these theories to the test over the coming years. Yep. But
I think the best thing you do is probably give him an exposure to other places, especially now. It's a great time to do it. Well, not now, not exactly now, but the concept of now where you can do that. And I talked to my wife recently. I'm like, hey, now, why don't we just go to live in when we can? I don't know. Pick a country, pick a place, pick a city somewhere for a couple of months. What's the difference? You know, now we can work from anywhere. So,
I think that's great. You know, I think that's a great philosophy. I mean, we definitely want our kids to have a fairly worldly outlook and, you know, see kind of places that aren't that functional. And, that's one of the other things. And people really, I think for a lot of Americans, they've lost perspective that as bad as things are in this country or, you know, in many ways, we're just a lot worse off than so much of the rest of the world. But, you know, that's until we determine that we're going to flush this down the toilet, which it seems like, you know, a number of people are getting convinced that we do need to flush this down the toilet. But the whole, like, you know, I think
there's also places a lot worse. Listen, I'm glad I visited Myanmar a couple of years back when it was all put together. You know, I've seen Cambodia. Look what the Khmer Rouge did back in the day. You know, you look at other countries around the world. So, you know, Haiti and other parts. So anyway, we could talk forever. Carson Block of Muddy Waters. Hey, I want to thank you so much for being on today. We'll put all the information on how to get in touch with you and get all the information from you over on the show notes for this episode. Thanks so much for joining us.
Cool. Thanks a lot, Andrew. Right,
great.
Take care.
And that's going to wrap it up for this episode of The Disciplined Investor. That was quite an entertaining, informational, educational, all around great discussion with Carson. So hopefully you learned a lot from that. We're going to be together next week again. Of course, we have a great guest coming there, Stephen Leeb. We're going to be talking about his thoughts on gold and what it means in the next generation of how we're investing in our currencies, etc. So make sure to pay attention to that one. Be here, be there, and make sure to subscribe. Thanks for joining me. Have a great weekend. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.
Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.